thing Jason and I have been talking about, and Bill mentioned as being kind of important. Now, this is another slide talking about the same thing. He thinks that with more data and more analysis of college batting and pitching performance, we can actually make better decisions. And one of the arguments he made is essentially around D2, D3, and junior colleges, okay, and how that might even translate all the way up to performance. And he also points out that this isn't just a sabermetric question, that another part of this is the value of actually getting D2, D3 scouting data as part of your analysis and really building out your whole system, not just D1, but through and through. So that's part of the rationale for looking more closely at collegiate data. Another person that actually Jeff talked to, Jason, you want to talk about it?
Yeah, so at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, when I was coaching at UC Santa Barbara years ago, I was fortunate enough to meet Scott Boras a few times because I was actually recruiting one of his sons who ended up going to USC. But we were speaking after he got done giving his speech to the entire audience, and I said, what do you feel, little background real quick, he believes with the guys that he represents, the high-profile high school guys, that unless the money is extremely high, they should go to college. His guys usually go to college, sticks to his number, and a lot of the times teams aren't going to give them what they're asking for, so they go to college, and he gets them their money 3 years later when they're juniors if their performance dictates that. So I asked him specifically, how do you think this new CBA is really going to affect the draft status of high school guys versus college guys? And he specifically said that the way the industry has now gone, how it's 40 rounds instead of 50, and the structure of after the 10th round, you're only getting a max of $100,000, you're not really going to be able to see the guys that are getting drafted lower, and the better players are going to be taken in that order. So, for example, Josh Bell last year went in the second round, signed for about $5 million. He said that's not really going to – he doesn't see that happening, but he prefaced it by saying it's going to play itself out this year. We're still learning, still trying to see this, but his opinion was he's going to see a lot more college guys getting drafted with this new structure of the collective bargaining agreement and less high school guys going and really working itself out when they're college juniors.
So that's another part of the rationale of doing this. And one of the things Jason did was look at the draft statistics and trying to tease out how many are from high school, college, JC, D2, D3, D1. And these are the numbers. So you're looking back from these years, the last 10 years or so, the Rule 4 draft statistics, it cuts this way. There's really not many D2, D3, NA, IA players. There's a lot of high schoolers represented, but Boras and others have made the argument that the CBA is going to change things. So because of that, because the college is going to be more of an emphasis in the Rule 4 draft, these numbers are going to shift, and you're probably going to see less these numbers drop for high school, and they're going to populate higher NAIA, Division 2, Division 3. So that's where these numbers are going to shift in the future. That's what most people believe. It's obviously the future, nobody knows, but that's the likeliest outcome. And so, again, the importance of the collegiate data, really trying to take a look at it, part of the rationale for our effort here to start looking at college data. So now here's the landscape of Division I. These are all different, just different little highlights of where they are, where they show up in the country. And here's another map showing it, which is kind of fun to look at, sort of the major colleges and what region they kind of populate. So pick your home and wherever you live, put a pin on it and see the college that's represented there. The way it works is there are a lot of different conferences. There's a lot of Division III teams. This year, there are 302 Division I teams. Okay, 302 teams covered all over these different conferences. Here's our region. We come from Boston, so Here's New England and the New York metro area. Tons of different teams there in Division I. Not thought of highly as a hotbed for collegiate performance, but this is where we are today. Look in Arizona, a hotbed for baseball. There's only two Division I teams in the state. And up.
But they have two of the league programs.
They're very league programs.
The weather allows the teams to start playing year round.
They're awesome. No doubt.
I grew up in the Northeast, pretty much. I mean, I put a Division III college team in, like, snow. I mean, the games in the middle of April being snowed out.
Right. So Holy Cross plays Arizona State 10 times, and we know the outcome. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is. But it's just an interesting fact. Now, how does Division I baseball kind of look? Now, you think about Division I baseball, and you really, like anything else in sabermetrics, you have to go to the runs. And so we started looking, trying to understand better the run scoring environment in Major League Baseball. Where do you get the data? Where do you start looking? There's different public sites, but the guy who's got the database that's publicly available is Boyd. Boyd's World has a database that goes from, 2002 to 2011. And it's populated with, every player season data. So if you want to start somewhere, this is where you start. This is where we start. We download the data. It's the publicly available data. And we started to try to look at this more carefully to try to better understand some relationships. And our initial goal was to just project, to just say, hey, if we see this player as a freshman and they have this line, what's it going to look like as a sophomore? What's a line, what's a player who's got a freshman and a sophomore player season line, what's it going to look like as a junior, etc. So that's our goal. We were thinking, this is possible. We take the data, we can start to project this out. And that's the whole thesis. That's the whole thing, what we're trying to do here. So one of the things that happens, though, we wanted to start with the run scoring environment. And you can't start talking about college baseball unless you start talking about the facts. Okay, so here's a graph, just a straight graph, straight from Boyd's World, all teams, all teams Division I, and it maps out runs per game, straight runs per game per team, average. So you can see this pattern here from 2002 on, being always over six runs a game, reaching seven around 2010, and then the drop-off. Everyone who follows collegiate baseball knows why. The bat changes here in 2011, a major change in the game and the run scoring potential in the game. So here's the data showing that there's a drastic change last year in the run scoring environment. We can also look at other measures, sabermetric measures, look at run estimators, the one run estimator that we use, that maybe we can show the others, show certainly, but runs created shows the same pattern. I'll flip back and forth, you can see it's the same thing. It's the same pattern, okay? And beyond just the basic runs and run estimators, you can also look at just measures of power, which ISO, we took linear weight of power. It shows the same pattern. So there's a correlation between power numbers, runs, and the whole run scoring environment. And this is a broader graph. I don't have a pointer here, but if you look, the graph we have for Boyd starts here. Okay, this is where it starts, and you can see it sort of flattening out, peaking, and coming down. Okay, but there are other bat changes. This is where they introduce aluminum bats. This is where they had to have a negative five on a bat here, and here they had to have a negative three. Every time they change the rule, they drop run score. So here they change the trampoline effect on the bat, drop run score, the new standard on the bat. And we had to take this into account. You can do projections, obviously, what you have to worry about is the run score in the environment. How do you adjust for that? So we were concerned about this. We should measure this and built it into our ideas and projection systems. So the other part to adjustments in any of this data is obviously park factors. These parks are very different. If you have 302 Division I teams, you have 302 different parks, all with different sort of structures, all with different orientations with the weather, all with different upfield sizes. So very different park factors came in. Now, Boyd does a nice job of this, and he actually has structured it with sort of four-year samples to get different year park factors. And it's actually well done. This is a good system that Boyd had done and put together. So we put this into all the records we have from Boyd to try to adjust the numbers. This is a summary of the repeated yearly high hitters parks, high park factors, and low park factors, the pitchers parks. There's an altitude effect that looks like, when you look at Air Force, you look at Northern Colorado, you look at New Mexico, the two New Mexico teams, they have high park numbers. So obviously this is a crucial piece to any idea of projection. You got to get the park factors, and Boyd does a nice job. And so after that, we thought, well, let's start trying to project. And when you start trying to project anything, you start with Marcel the Monkey. Now, believe it or not, that's actually Marcel the Monkey. It was a character in Friends, and Tango, when he developed a system, named it Marcel after, you know, the monkey. And this is actually part of the reason. So I'm showing David Schwimmer here as our inspiration. But so we tried that. We tried to do Marcel-like systems on the data we had, trying to build a model out. Now, Marcel's, if you know this projection system at all, it's for major league data. It's got a regression term. It's very simple. It looks 3 years past data, weighted a little differently, and, you know, 3 years past. And it has a simple little age adjustment. It's a very simple projection system that isn't too crazy hard to implement. I don't know why someone doesn't publish Marcel's the day after, you know, the Lehman database comes up. You know, as soon as the Lehman database comes up for the previous year, do Marcel's and then later. But it's a straightforward system. We had to play with the numbers, the regression numbers, the other constants in the Marcel algorithm. We played with them a little bit, try to do that. Now, the way we did it, Jason can talk about how we did this here. We looked at specific players.
So I looked at specific players that I either played against or coached against that I knew had played three consecutive years for full seasons, and did each one. I created a kind of a spreadsheet with my scaled down Marcel's from college level, and it worked pretty well. It correlated very strongly with what their actual performance was. So I would take their first three years and run it through Marcel's, and then look at what it shot out, and then compare that to what their actual data was for their senior year. And that really worked well. And then I tried to do it again for their junior year, because some of the best players obviously were drafted after junior year, like it's 3 years of data. So I did it for that, and that worked well. So I did it for about 20 different players, and it seemed to work very, very well. I was extremely satisfied and happy, and then I was like, okay, let's try and move this into the aggregate overall NCAA type of sample size. And that obviously did not run well at all. I mean, the correlations were so extreme on the other end from where it was individually, and that's when started talking to Andy. I was like, this is not looking what it shows individually. When you look at one of the guys that I used, actually, was Brandon Crawford. Brandon Crawford, obviously, now would be San Francisco Giants. I did his 2 years in college and then tried to project his junior year. When I ran it individually, it works great. And then I tried to run it for everybody else individually that I looked at, and it worked great. And as soon as I put it in for the overall NCAA database for that year, it just completely kind of went berserk on me. I'm looking at it saying, okay, now we need to try and figure out what these new coefficients and figure out what their the best values for them for the overall NCAA Division I would be.
Right, so the modified Marcel that we ran, you know, and our test cases worked, didn't work overall. And when we talked, we realized the key factor here is this translation. You needed better information, real good information, on sort of what you'd call the aging curve. Classic aging curve you see in Major League Baseball through the minors. So this idea, we wanted to better understand these translations between the different years. Okay, so we tried to look at, you know, this basic idea, these are the aging curves for Major League Baseball. I'm not here to argue one over the other method, but or with what the number is. But that was the idea, was to look at the idea of collegiate class. If you saw a freshman, there most likely would be a transition to what they'd be as a sophomore. And then another transition to being a junior, and another transition to being a senior. I hadn't thought about red shirts yet, but that comes up later. I learned the, you know, the problem. But that was our idea. In trying to see how we can improve our modified Marcel, we're saying, this is really crucial. It's a really crucial transition. Maybe there's another thing we have to do to massage data that might help a projection system. Okay, so that's what we did. The other model here, though, would be to go straight with age, get the age of the player, and just say, well, this player's 17, 18, 19, what's it going to look like at 20? And do a straight aging curve. And, you know, we discussed the merits of using the age, you know, the aging curve versus this class translation. And we, because we have no birthday data with Boyd's database, we had to go with class translation. We didn't have the skill to be able to mine whatever's out there to determine these players' birthdays. And I'm sure there's somebody who could do something smart about that, but I couldn't. Could find these birthdays easily. So we just went with the database and decided to look, try to look at this transition between classes, freshman to sophomore, sophomore to junior, junior to senior, to see what would help. And so we started looking at the database more carefully. And here are our methods. It turns out there are 58,000 plus player seasons in the Boyd database. And that, you know, that's a lot of data. A lot of player season data, and that's good. It gives us a lot of data to work with to try to find these translations. So, a lot to be said for what's there. He also is very clear he's got all complete player seasons from 2002 on, and that's one of the reasons why people who do some of this work start in 2002. They ignore the database, they ignore the information in Boyd's world that's pre-2002 because it's scattered, it's not complete. So you start at 2002, and we did that. So then I started trying to work with the data to create this idea of determining somebody's class. So I had a simple little script algorithm to do it. I wanted to find out class. All I did was start with the earliest year, which I'm pretty sure was 1958, but you know, I just wanted to start looking at this idea of naming the different classes from these player season records. And it's a pretty simple little algorithm. Start early. If I find a new name, I start a new field, which is a freshman. And then if I go to the next field and it's the same name, it's, you know, sort of like if I find the name again, it's the same team, then I call that a sophomore. If I find the name again down the record, a junior senior. So I just do a simple script and start naming the classes with a very simple little algorithm, nothing complex. Okay, so now it turns out that when I did this, I started seeing the fifth year, the post, so there's a lot of records in there, 5 years. And obviously that's a redshirt year. I said, oh, right, of course, there's redshirt years. And so I figured that out too. I started naming that post, and I don't know why, you know, I just picked a name. So I start trying to build translations just by getting the year right, the class right for these players, and we went from there. And so we had different problems with this. First problem I realized is that it doesn't do well with players that have the same name. Players that have the same name, my little script would fail. I thought, okay, what do I do with that? How do I build some intelligence there? If a player transferred to a different school, my little script failed too, because it was just looking for names in schools. So lots of players transferred, and the data, my failure rate was pretty high. They misspelled either the school or the player's name. It was another failure in this little script to get the classes right in this database. So there's also, the database is inconsistent. There's, you know, Boyd has team name, but it changes from year to year for some reason. I found out different team names that changed over the years. And so that was something that came up as I'm building this little season, you know, this little class. You know. So
same name, is that like just last name or last name and first name?
I was using last name and first name. That's how it shows up in the database. It shows up, you know, as a combination. And still, there were duplicate names.
Yeah.
Still, there were transfers. And there's misspellings. So there's just mistakes. And so I'm finding the mistakes as I wrote my little script. 58,000 records, and I don't know how many mistakes there were. But what I ended up doing was flagging the mistakes. So instead of just, you know, letting go, I could have just stopped there and said, oh, screw it, it's fine, it's close enough, and go from there. But some part of me said, no, I got to try to get this right. In retrospect, I should have stopped there and just said, oh, it's fine, let's go on. But I pressed on, but the problem is there were a lot of mistakes. And I'm sure some of you have looked at these data. And if you have, you probably know the pain and suffering it took to actually work through the issues in these data. But I've joined the club, trust me. I know exactly all the different foibles of trying to just name class. That's all I'm trying to do is name freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. And so Literally, I personally scanned all 58,000 records looking for my problem flag, and then I had to try to do something. So, turns out, every time I had the problem, I made a best guess, and this is something important. I made a best guess on things. When I tried to determine with this database whether it looked like a transfer. And when I looked at transfers, believe it or not, the vast majority, way over 50% of transfers are very much in the same region. If they went 1 year to Texas A&M and they didn't get much playing time, they transferred to Texas Tech or something like that, Southwest Texas. It was a real regional thing. It was a big clue. Players seem to stick around if they transfer in the same region. Is that your observation as a coach and a scout? When you transfer, you're not transferring across the country. No, that's not always true. When some high-profile D1 players, if they're not getting playing time in Nebraska, they will transfer to another high-profile D1 team. The coaches obviously know them. They get that guy who's not getting playing time. So there were transfers at high-level program level. But if you weren't in the high-level program, it was mostly because you were transferring just around the corner. So that was a pattern to me I kept seeing, and I used that pattern to identify. You know, if I saw the sequence of years being close, I said, okay, that's likely a transfer. You got to remember, I wasn't mining the data saying, oh, I checked news reports for Stephen O'Donnell transferring from here to here. I didn't do any of that. I just took my best guess. And for what it's worth, that's what I did for 58,000 records. Now, a lot of times it's the same name, but it's separated by years, obviously different players. If the years were separate, there's no way it could be the same person. I obviously named that players, classified their class differently. So I just want to emphasize, though, that this is not anything except my interpretation. I'm giving you my algorithm, I'm telling you what I did, and, I'll show you the database. You can look at it if you want to. And you can critique it all you want on my decisions on this, because that's what it was. This is literally my best guess about the class of those problem cases. Then, after that, what do you do with the redshirt players? After I did all this massaging of data, I'd always try to find the redshirts in there too. They're pretty obvious when you see, the same player going for 5 years. And when I saw redshirt data, I tried to, determine, is this redshirt or is this a new player? And so I just did my best guess here. But even after cleaning out the data, you came up with players with the fifth year. And then, when they had the fifth year, it really is a choice here. At this point, you can either do two things. You can translate through, like it's just 5 years, or you can say it's a redshirt year, and you can say, well, if the redshirt year really is a lost year, which is really what it's supposed to be in the NCAA, maybe the best thing to do is to take it out. So that's what I did. I went through all the cases of redshirt years and tried to determine again with my best guess which year was the redshirt. It was pretty obvious. 90% of the time, redshirt. Really clear of the five, which was the year that was, they took the redshirt. So that wasn't a problem. A couple times you're like, what am I looking at here? And so I just did my best guess again, just to get the data. Now, so it was, once again, it was by inspection, and I determined the redshirt. Now, so the rationale was that I wanted to have consistent 4 years for the whole database, and I didn't want to do the 5th year, so I went to the other. It wasn't too hard. It certainly wasn't as hard as going through 15,000 records. So that's what you went through to get these data. And so then I, some of the basics, other basics were I took out anybody with zero plate appearances. A lot of players in there were clearly, you could see they had high putouts and assists. Defensive players, they had high stolen base attempts, high caught stealings, obviously some kind of, pinch runner. But a lot of players were in the database with zero plate appearances, and they were clearly pinch runners and defensive specialists. And so I took them out of this because we were going to look at bad. Calculated various offensive stats from this database. Pretty complete. You got your basic stat line that you can generate other advanced stats from. And so I used the basic run scoring adjustment, which is how runs have changed over the 10-year period of data. And then I also did park adjustments in this database, and then start calculating more of these, advanced, more advanced run estimators that were out there. So I considered, I talked to a long time over lunch with Jason on this about what to do with strength of schedule. Because Boyd has some indication of the strength of schedule in his data, so we tried to consider what to do with that. We looked at the numbers, we thought, how do we adjust for this? And it got complex enough that we weren't sure what we were doing. And I wasn't sure how well it was done. So once we had questions, we said, you know what, let's just keep going. This is where we cut short. So let's analyze what we had. So then the idea was now look at the data, look at trends over these classes. So here are just some straight numbers. We ended up with 51,800 records. 25,000 were players who played just 1 year. Database was in for just 1 year. 14,000 players had played 2 years. Almost 8,000 had played through junior year, and then about 3,600 played a fourth year. And obviously, because of the draft, you know, elite players in the U.S. have been junior year, a lot of players have their senior year. Turns out, when I looked at the database, there were 138 redshirt seasons where, you know, we had to say, I actually made it a zero, and I said, that's a redshirt season we want to include it in our classification of translating between freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior year.
How much percent of those freshmen actually be junior college transfers?
Yes, they could be. But maybe you're probably right. Probably you should better call them first year players, second year players.
Junior college transfers.
Yeah.
Exactly. Juniors.
That's right. So you're right. I should adjust what I'm calling. They are first year NCAA Division I players. So that's probably a better name for them. Now, so here's some data. This is just average games played, you know, meant average games started, and then plate appearances per game for all these different data sets. These are big data sets. So once we classified them and had all those records, you can see that there's trends here now just on games played. And, you know, I mean, this makes sense. Obviously, some coach is, you know, making determination about who's playing games. And, you know, if you ask a coach and their seniors are better than their freshmen and they know the freshmen will be around next year, they're going to, you know, I don't know, there's a tilting towards the seniors, obviously. The redshirt data was interesting because that seems to indicate that it was a lost year, but I chose it for that. I mean, I chose, there's certainly a bias here in my choice. When I chose redshirt years, those are years with low games played, low games started. Plate appearances per game have a similar trend. You can see them increasing over their class over time. This makes sense with the coaches. But this is basic, sort of, the basic translation data. You can sort of see how it trends. Now, freshman games started is actually much lower than games played, but that makes sense too. A lot of freshmen don't walk into a program and start a lot of games. That's what these data show, supporting what you might think. Now onto skills here over time, the walk rate actually increases with time. And you know that sort of makes sense. I tried to piece this together and I thought, well, if it represents players who sort of play 1 year and then sort of fade away, you know, maybe you have a selection bias towards players of talent as you go higher in the classes. Junior to senior year, you know, that's harder to get at. But clearly, when you look at the freshman, the sophomore, junior year, you're talking about other kind of translations that are interesting. But the junior, senior year, you know, these are players who are more established, I think. So it's interesting that you get the change in walk rate. Same thing with strikeout rates. Okay, they're decreasing as the time goes on. But here, you can see juniors and seniors are more likely. Same. I think. If I put these, I should put these into repeated measures NOVA and test these out. I just so describing it though, this is more of the skill sets. Here's walks per K is this sense of, you know, what people talk about when they talk about this stat. It's a sense of the ability to discern the strike zone. It's a crude measure, and you can see that maybe there's some increasing discernment of the strike zone. Their batting eye is increasing. Another skill set is contact rate. That's obviously going up. Make sure you check the y-axis about this, though. You know, it's not going to zero. But you can see there's an increasing contact rate. That's another skill that's obviously, you know, represents part of batting performance, hitting performance. So these are some of the scale data. Some of the other basic data rates. Once again, you can sort of see these transitions. On-base percentage, OPS, isolated slugging, and linear weighted power. You can see these increasing trends too. And once again, I think it's pretty clear why freshman to sophomore, sophomore to junior might be changing. It gets more interesting what might be changing between junior and senior. I think there's some extra thought that needs to be done about why that's changing so much in this sample set of about 3,000 different players that we have in this database. So beyond that, we started looking at these run estimators. Same trend, okay? Freshman to senior year, you see arc-adjusted, season run-adjusted, you know, WOBA going up, arc-adjusted runs created per game going up. So we did, you know, this is all park and season adjusted games going up. So these data here, they show these trends, okay? And like I said, food for thought about why, especially junior and senior year. Now, the basic summary of what we found and the conclusions here, the advancing classes, we show data here that advancing classes advance both skills, basic grade stats, and advanced run estimates. That's what the data show. Now, I don't think it's groundbreaking that this would be that way, especially when you understand the earlier years. Okay? The skills increases were fairly significant. I'll walk you through these numbers. 20% increase from junior, what this means is the freshman to sophomore transition was 20%. We're batting high, we're reporting the first line. 11% was the sophomore to junior transition, and 10% was the junior to senior transition. So that's just straight translation of the skill. And to me, that's interesting. I still think that's something to consider, why there'd be such a big jump in this batting eye measure, from junior to senior especially. I have to noodle out one more. I welcome any suggestions you would have about that. Power measures, they had about an 18-13-3 transition between the three translations between the different years. There was a bigger one in the beginning, and then once again, that makes sense by sampling. OPS, these other ones had sort of a 10%, 5%, 3% change between classes. So those are the results. And the other conclusions to make here, obviously, the only publicly available database that was relatively complete, that we could start with, it's extremely variable relative to the reliability that we get in other databases, the Lehman database, you know, what you find from RetroSheet, Baseball Data Bank. It's just there's a lot of things that need to be worked on these data here to clean them up and make them more representative of what it is. It's a huge amount of data, just a lot of data, but it's just much more variable. It's certainly not as crisp and clean, hasn't been vetted at all like major league data. It is inaccurate. Not many people, I bet some in the room have, but not many people have gone through these data very carefully. And even I, scrolling through the 58,000 records, I wouldn't say I went through it carefully. I was looking for problems that showed up just trying to identify classes. That's one way to comb through the data. There's 20 other ways to comb through the data to check its accuracy, and I just didn't do it. I did one version of combing through the data. We did classic, hitting projection systems. We thought we had the model right, and we thought we had to tweak it by looking at these translations, okay? I reported the basic data. It's not that surprising around the class translations. Some of these might be surprising, especially the junior, senior year translation, and then also the batting eye stuff. I'm not sure what that is. But I really think, and the take-home message here that I want to, if you think that this is useful, and I do think it has some value in this whole area of looking at different levels of college, and AIA, D2, D3, D1, these translations between divisions and translations between different years, this is part of it. It's certainly part of it. And I actually submit that given the Marcel problem and the huge amount of data and the non-consistency of the player itself, the wide range of skill sets of players walking through the door that you're trying to project, that I think a translation system much more along the lines of sort of here's what this player looks like and here's how we translate that player to the next level. It's a more complicated model. It's not a simple Marcel model. It's a complicated translational model that builds in looking at all different components of what hitting is, all different components of what pitching is. So my conclusion after trying to look at these data, look at how they translate between years and how to project them to the next year, is the model has to probably be built out much more thorough, much more complex, and it probably involves the foundation is this idea, I think the foundation is this idea of looking year to year. Now, this is just the beginning. I think some of you have asked these last few days about these data. I basically say it's really messy, and it is. This is a messy operation. But it's right at the beginning, and I do think it has value for those people who really understand that these data, these players actually have, you know, thinking about what these players are and how they might actually translate to major league players is important for major league teams. The other piece here that's really important is D2, D3, and AIA. Looking at these players more thoroughly, and maybe just doing data mining, you know, broadly on what you see, having a good sense of these translations gets you, maybe it makes it more efficient on the scouting and the looks of these people, especially if you know more about the translations. You know more how they translate up and down the collegiate levels to the pro levels to Major League Baseball. So thank you for your attention. I just present these data for your consideration, and any questions you have about this would help both of us an awful lot. So thank you very much.
Questions for you. You talk about the variance, especially in the performance on the hitting side. You saw a wider variance than we normally see, I suppose, looking at organized baseball, closer to baseball teams, even starting at the lowest level. You're looking at offense. What about pitching? And would there be a likelihood? I think there might be just a likelihood that the variance in performance would be greater on that pitching side.
My first, if you asked me to predict, I'd say it'd be the same. I'm curious why you think it'd be more.
Because I would think that even at that level of competition, pitchers would likely be less. Have a feeling that you'd see the freshmen especially throwing fewer innings even than play appearances you see on the first year. And then you would see a greater proportion of the workload at the more senior level.
But I think also if you look at just obviously when you look at the hitter data and you look at their walks and strikeout ratios and how they get better as they get older. Pitchers in college baseball, you try to get them innings, especially with freshmen, first-year players, younger guys, you want to try and put them in situations to succeed. And the data obviously shows that even younger players are not succeeding as much as they are later in their career. So when you're talking about pitching, that's one of the things that hopefully we're going to be able to get to is trying to throw in the data and put it on the pitching side. But I would agree with Andy on just it seems like it's going to stay proportionate to what the hitters are doing, just based on knowing the college layout and seeing the strikeout to walk rates, just looking at it on an aggregate, knowing what their stats are without breaking it down by class yet, but seeing just looking at the number of innings pitched per year.
It's a testable hypothesis. Yeah. You can look at the variability and you can start understanding better what these younger players have in terms of variability of skills and performance and map it out. But my first prediction would be different than yours. I actually
think it's sort of going on, I think, at least in part of anecdotal thinking that Alex Meyer, terrible at Kentucky in the first 2 years. Much better than fair. Marcus Stone, awful in the first year. Much better than
he was also playing position.
Right. So
can you adjust? just to the ballparks? Is that true? How did you get like that data from like maybe the mean win low back in 58? How do you get like ballpark data from like college parks in like the 60s and 70s that they obviously don't play in parks?
Well, we only use the data from 2002 to 2001.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The Boyd database goes back to 58, but it's spotty. I forget what teams he's got all these records.
Oh, okay. So you just use 2002, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
That's when he's got complete player season data, all players in NCAA.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
And the reason for that actually is the implementation of the sports information directors in NCAA for D1, D2, D3 using a unified stat group program that they all use to keep score. So that's now it's online. Everybody
can kind
of see.
Another question. Those guys only 50 starting pitchers are weekly guys. Not every 5 days, not every 3 days for us. So they pitch on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I guess there's a game. So you've got a different allocation of workload right there. I'm just wondering how that's going to be analyzed.
It's the game. It's how they do it. You're the Friday night game.
There's also other times where the closer on Friday is also the Sunday starter. So it's, I mean, hopefully that's what we're going to do next is look at pitching to be able to see it. But it'll definitely be interesting to see what the results are.
One thing, and you sort of mentioned this a little bit, is that there's a little bit of a bias in that, you know, players who get to play in their junior and senior year are likely, it's because they're better players already. So what might be interesting to look at for me is, say, take the 3,600 seniors that were in the database and look at their freshman, sophomore, junior, mm-hmm. senior years, because that would kind of control for that bias.
Yep. I think that's right. You obviously have people dropping out all over the place at different years for different reasons, whatever it is. Some of them, I can tell by screening the data, that a lot of them is they just lost eligibility. That actually is a valuable tool, just within player model. And this is along the lines of, you know, the way CODA does its work is trying to look at player models and saying modeling, looking at comps and saying these comps can continue. So that kind of, you know, non-simple comp model is probably going to be more successful with these data than a simple more simple. Along those lines, it's got a list of what this is.
It will definitely be interesting. I think there will be a lot more frontline guys that you're seeing, and by their junior year, they're probably just going to be phenomenal. But I don't know if that is actually going to change what that discrepancy has been in the state. But it's going to get that data went the way, obviously, until 5 years out to see what that difference is.
It can affect the bias where you have, like, in places like Arizona, which that's a higher level of competition in the conferences in the warm climates than, say, those smaller schools in the Northeast where you may not get, I mean, consistently warm weather until the end of April and the season ends in May. So it's, I mean, therefore, players might produce prodigious stats at a Northeastern school, but they probably wouldn't be the star of the ASU.
I'll give it my shot. Here's what I think of it. I think this is true. I think that clustering of talent at ASU is very biased. You've got a lot, you know, you've got your 25 spots. The 25, the range of talent,
right,
ability, and skill is this. Mm-hmm. At ASU, they're all over here. They're all at one end.
Yes.
At Tufts, where we come from, it's D3. These students aren't, you know, they're getting recruited, they're great baseball players, but they're not clustering over here like ASU. It's D3. But you're going to get a diamond in the rough at the D3 schools all the time. There are players, I know there are players at D3 who could play at ASU. I know that's true.
Right, but ASU has produced like 100 major league baseball players, and Tufts probably has zero.
We have one. Okay.
But you'd be surprised. USC leads the way with, they just broke the over 100 players in the big league mark this year. They lead the way of all schools and guys getting drafted and playing in the big leagues. Obviously, we looked at just drafted players, not guys making it to the big leagues. But just thinking off the top of my head and looking at the data for the past few years, I want to say Long Beach State has the most big leaguers in big leagues right now. And going off of the
Long Beach State's in California. So
yes. But what I wanted to try and relate that to is also the park factors.
Yeah.
When you look at the park factors, Long Beach State is a pitcher's park.
Yeah.
It is a graveyard. And the correlation when I first wanted to look at the park factors and thinking about it, I thought that the colder weather schools are going to have the extreme higher pitching areas because you can still throw maybe with a few miles less velocity, but the hitters can get in on the hitter's hands. They're going to feel it for the rest of the game. Mm-hmm. And that really isn't the case. When you have Long Beach State, you have UC Davis, both in California, as pitchers' parks. And you have Air Force Academy, which is in colder weather, as a hitter park.
But it's 6,000 feet elevation.
Right, but you're still in a colder weather where hitters' hands, if you get in on hitters' hands, he's going to be feeling it. So I think that the park factor balances it out, not fully, but a little bit, and explains the warmer weather to that colder weather relationship. But ultimately, I mean, you're looking at the Long Beach State. They've got some pretty good pitchers in the big leagues. They also have a lot of hitters.
But that's California. California's also got a lot of humidity, and all the California major league teams have good pitching parks. Or mostly, obviously, Dodger Stadium and Oakland and San Diego, particularly San Francisco, Anaheim as much, but.
The adjustment of the strength of schedule is crucial.
Yeah.
And I think this is what gets away. We didn't do it, but doing it the right way is absolutely important. So getting the right neutral stats that you can start comparing people to each other. So by neutralizing the strength of schedule is important. I thought you were making the argument, everybody's so good in Arizona, they're different. Well, yeah, they are different. Arizona beats Tufts morning, noon, and night. Mm-hmm. But the level of talent, actually measuring the player, at the best levels of D3, D2, Harvard, Northeastern, Maine, there are players there who are going to, if they get the shot, they get the scouting, they get the, somehow they get seen, the opportunity, they have a shot. And that's the difference.
It's to try and find those, diamonds, the rough, those guys who are playing maybe in the north but don't get the opportunity to play year-round, guys in Arizona and California do.
I think they're there, and I think they're underrepresented right now. That's a gut feeling, mm-hmm. because I just know how talent distributes, right? How talent develops. Talent distributes and develops everywhere. It's happening in places where you don't think it's happening. But, so, I can guarantee you there are players who play the Tufts who can play in the ASU. They would make the team and play. You just don't know them. And there are not many.
Yeah.
It's rare.
If you don't get the opportunity to play, if your guy grows up in India, you'll probably never play. You might play cricket, you can play baseball, but you'll never.
The Pirates try that.
Okay.
Do you guys think, just your own opinion here, do you think there's a difference going off of the difference in talent and the Pac-12 or whoever else? Do you think the aging curves would be approximately similar at all different conferences, or do you think there might be more extreme?
I think for just really quickly off the top of my head, I was fortunate enough, I coached in the Ivy League. The Ivy League guys, unless they're signing, unless they're getting drafted very high, they play all 4 years. And maybe that aging curve, because you're having a fourth-year senior that played all 4 years there, where if he was at another major conference school, he probably would have been drafted and signed after his junior year. So that number right there might say something. But other than that, I don't I don't think the aging curve, I think it's going to be pretty consistent throughout the conferences.
I know, I mean, I know that ASU, because almost everyone who plays for ASU gets drafted, so they have very few fourth-year seniors on the team, and because just about a third year, well, we've gone football. Yeah, and maybe a lower-level school where you get fewer drafted players, that will have a higher percentage of seniors.
But also, as a general rule, as a division coach, if your team is loaded with seniors, you're not developing them well enough to try and get them drafted as a junior. Your goal is to try and get your guys in and get drafted out of their junior year, and if they want to sign them, they do.
To answer your question, Pete, real quick, I would say, though, that it's important probably to do it, especially D2, D3 levels. You know, D1 at the schools with the, you know, the easier schedules, the known schools, what you're talking about, that diamond in the rough, is somebody who develops, somebody who's not been seen in the big high school combines, the big games, Under Armour and the others. So they're sort of under the radar already. They go to an under the radar school. Whatever's inside them internally makes them develop more. So it probably could be something different on these translations. But generally, I think we still have to get it right first, especially with Boyd's data. That kind of level of data access, data we have access to. We've got to do a lot more before we're worried about division, conference issues.
I'm curious, from your experience in college baseball, does some kind of day-to-day go on for coaches to transfer out of JC or schools? Does it seem like that would be a huge advantage for looking for your value player?
That's actually the website I've actually started recently. Trying to do that and supply that to some of the college teams, but the resources that you have as a college coach, you don't have the full resource like a football or a basketball program. Baseball, you have limited funds. Sometimes your top assistant that's making minimal money, your second assistant on no money, and you're just trying to get through that season and do well. In essence, the head coach is the general manager, he's the scouting director, he's everything, he's got authority on that. And to add that on top of it, yeah, it'd be great to have that data and be able to do it, but logistically it's not possible with how much time they're spending coaching and the limitations on the field. But then you have, as a coach, you're in the fall, guys are allowed to spend 6 hours a week on the field, but in groups of six. So the coach is on the field for 7-8 hours, but each guy's only on the field for a half hour each. So it's just trying to figure out that balancing act, it doesn't play in the equation. So kind of answer what you do is you call scouts. You call scouts that you have a relationship with in that area and say, hey, who have you seen lately at the junior college level? Who have you seen lately at the high school level that we should be on? And you also have limitations on when you can go out and actually recruit. So that kind of plays into it. So you just have to, you develop your relationships with the people that you trust, and you go off of what they say, and then that kind of guides you. Instead of the numbers, that guides you in the right direction on where to look.
Do the variance in umpire performance create some problems in terms of comparing across the entire D1 versus D1, D2, etc.? I can imagine that umpiring, say, in Southeast Conference might be a little bit higher level of excellence than you might find.
You'd be surprised, because a lot of those umpires actually work both ways. Yes, there's like the West Coast, there's one West Coast guy that runs, I want to say, the Big West, Pac-10, the WCC, and I want to say the Mountain West. And I mean, there's regional guys that are the chairman of those areas, and for some reason, some of the Northeast schools are also run by some of the Southeast guys. It's strange. I don't remember which conferences go in which area, which guy that runs it, but there are some that you see overlap.
Well, thank you again for your quick. Oh, Darren,
I just one quick. Did you try to get an informal vetting of this from any of the team? Baseball ops department, do this projection stuff?
we've had conversations with baseball ops, but they're probably doing something more advanced than using
horseshoes. I'm sure they are, because A, they spend more time and money on it, and B, they clean up the data, they have more data. What I'm saying is, did you try to talk to anyone and say, hey, is this in the ballpark, or are we on the right track, and did you get that kind of feedback?
Yes, I did, actually. I spoke with Sig McDonald. I called him and told him this is what I was working on, this is what I'm doing. And obviously, everybody's going to protect their trade secrets. Yeah. No one wants to give away anything. But I said, is pretty much the way I phrased it was, is this possible? Am I wasting my time trying to figure this stuff out? And he said, it is possible that you're going in the right direction. That's pretty much all he gave there. So at least we knew we weren't wasting time.
Right. I mean, this is still, two guys part-time in Boston having fun with data.
Football, basketball, which is far more interesting. In the case of basketball, far more interesting. Football, far more interesting. This kind of stuff is where being a pound low speed, for the last 4 years of the year, if you start playing baseball, 4 years. Baseball is a conflict.
It's clear we're going to. There's something happening next weekend in Boston called the Boston Baseball Hack Day, which is pretty cool. It's put together by the Globe, and they're bringing in all the techie programmers who like baseball, and all the baseball people who have a bunch of questions like we do. And so we're hopeful that we're going to hook up with one of these good Python programmers who can scrape all the stuff we need and maybe get information with good algorithms that can build this up much more reliably. And then building out databases that we can actually start analyzing more thoroughly with better questions and really developing an area where, hey, what's interesting here? And in my mind right away, I want to start thinking about the stuff John mentioned too, thinking about what's going on here with some of these data. Why don't they, why do they look a certain way? So, let's start trying to ask questions. Thank you very much for your attention. Do you like that? Oh, really?
Yeah, that's right.